Chapter 4. Empty of everything but echoes and moldiness, with the single exception of Picklison on a piece of red drugget. This suited my purpose, as I wanted a private and confidential word with him, which was, Picklison. Owing much happiness to you, I put you in my will for a fippunit. But, to save trouble, here's for punting down, which may equally suit your views, and let us so conclude the transaction. Picklison, who up to that remark had had the dejected appearance of a long Roman rushlight that couldn't anyhow get lighted, brightened up at his top extremity, and made his acknowledgments in a way which, for him, was parliamentary eloquence. He likewise did add, that, having ceased to draw as a Roman, Mim had made proposals for his going in as a converted Indian giant worked upon by the dairyman's daughter. This, Picklison, having no acquaintance with the tract named after that young woman, and not being willing to couple gag with his serious views, had declined to do, thereby leading to words and the total stoppage of the unfortunate young man's beer. All of which, during the whole of the interview, was confirmed by the ferocious growling of Mim down below in the pay place, which shook the giant like a leaf. But what was to the present point in the remarks of the traveling giant, otherwise Picklison, was this. Dr. Marigold, I give his words without a hope of conveying their feebleness. Who is the strange young man that hangs about your carts? The strange young man? I gives him back, thinking that he meant her, and his languid circulation had dropped a syllable. Doctor, he returns, with a pathos calculated to draw a tear from even a manly eye, I am weak, but not so weak yet as that I don't know my words. I repeat them, doctor. The strange young man. It then appeared that Picklison, being forced to stretch his legs, not that they wanted it, only at times, when he couldn't be seen for nothing, to wit in the dead of the night and towards daybreak, had twice seen hanging about my carts, in that same town of Lancaster, where I had been only 2 nights, the same unknown young man. It put me rather out of sorts. What it meant, as to particulars I no more foreboded then than you forebode now, but it put me rather out of sorts. Howsoever, I made light of it to Picklison, and I took leave of Picklison, advising him to spend his legacy in getting up his stamina, and to continue to stand by his religion. Towards morning I kept a lookout for the strange young man, and what was more I saw the strange young man. He was well dressed and well looking. He loitered very nigh my carts, watching them like, as if he was taking care of them, and soon after daybreak turned and went away. I sent a hail after him, but he never started or looked round, or took the smallest notice. We left Lancaster within an hour or two, on our way towards Carlisle. Next morning, at daybreak, I looked out again for the strange young man. I did not see him. But next morning I looked out again, and there he was once more. I sent another hail after him, but as before he gave not the slightest sign of being anyways disturbed. This put a thought into my head. Acting on it, I watched him in different manners, and at different times not necessary to enter into, till I found that this strange young man was deaf and dumb. The discovery turned me over, because I knew that a part of that establishment where she had been was allotted to young men, some of them well off, and I thought to myself, if she favors him, where am I? And where is all that I have worked and planned for? Hoping I must confess to the selfishness, that she might not favor him, I set myself to find out. At last I was by accident present at a meeting between them in the open air, looking on leaning behind a fir tree without their knowing of it. It was a moving meeting for all the three parties concerned. I knew every syllable that passed between them as well as they did. I listened with my eyes, which had come to be as quick and true with deaf and dumb conversation as my ears with the talk of people that can speak. He was a going out to China as clerk in a merchant's house, which his father had been before him. He was in circumstances to keep a wife, and he wanted her to marry him and go along with him. She persisted, no. He asked if she didn't love him. Yes, she loved him dearly, dearly, but she could never disappoint her beloved, good, noble, generous, and I don't know what all father meaning me, the cheap jack in the sleeved waistcoat, and she would stay with him, heaven bless him, though it was to break her heart. Then she cried most bitterly, and that made up my mind. While my mind had been in an unsettled state about her favoring this young man, I had felt that unreasonable towards Picklesen, that it was well for him, he had got his legacy down. For I often thought, if it hadn't been for this same weak-minded giant, I might never have come to trouble my head, and vex my soul about the young man. But, once that I knew she loved him, once that I had seen her weep for him, it was a different thing. I made it right in my mind with Picklesen on the spot, and I shook myself together, to do what was right by all. She had left the young man by that time, for it took a few minutes, to get me thoroughly well shook together, and the young man was leaning against another of the fir trees, of which there was a cluster, with his face upon his arm. I touched him on the back. Looking up and seeing me, he says, in our deaf and dumb talk, do not be angry. I am not angry, good boy. I am your friend. Come with me. I left him at the foot of the steps of the library cart, and I went up alone. She was drying her eyes. You have been crying, my dear. Yes, father. Why? A headache. Not a heartache? I said a headache, father. Dr. Marigold must prescribe for that headache. She took up the book of my prescriptions, and held it up with a forced smile, but seeing me keep still and look earnest, she softly laid it down again, and her eyes were very attentive. The prescription is not there, Sophie. Where is it? Here, my dear. I brought her young husband in, and I put her hand in his, and my only farther words to both of them were these. Dr. Marigold's last prescription. To be taken for life. After which I bolted. When the wedding come off, I mounted a coat blue and bright buttons, for the first and last time in all my days, and I give Sophie away with my own hand. There were only us three and the gentleman who had had charge of her for those 2 years. I give the wedding dinner of 4 in the library cart. Pigeon pie, a leg of pickled pork, a pair of fowls, and suitable garden stuff. The best of drinks. I give them a speech, and the gentlemen give us a speech, and all our jokes told, and the whole went off like a skyrocket. In the course of the entertainment I explained to Sophie that I should keep the library cart as my living cart when not upon the road, and that I should keep all her books for her just as they stood, till she come back to claim them. So she went to China with her young husband, and it was a parting sorrowful and heavy, and I got the boy I had another service, and so as of old, when my child and wife were gone, I went plodding along alone, with my whip over my shoulder, at the old horse's head. Sophie wrote me many letters, and I wrote her many letters. About the end of the first year she sent me one in an unsteady hand. Dearest father, not a week ago I had a darling little daughter, but I am so well, that they let me write these words to you. Dearest and best father, I hope my child may not be deaf and dumb, but I do not yet know. When I wrote back, I hinted the question. But as Sophie never answered that question, I felt it to be a sad one, and I never repeated it. For a long time our letters were regular, but then they got irregular, through Sophie's husband being moved to another station, and through my being always on the move. But we were in one another's thoughts, I was equally sure, letters or no letters. 5 years, odd months, had gone since Sophie went away. I was still the king of the cheap jacks, and at a greater height of popularity than ever. I had had a first-rate autumn of it, and on the 23rd of December, 1864, I found myself at Uxbridge, Middlesex, clean sold out. So I jogged up to London with the old horse, light and easy, to have my Christmas Eve and Christmas Day alone by the fire in the library cart, and then to buy a regular new stock of goods all round, to sell them again, and get the money. I am a neat hand at cookery, and I'll tell you what I knocked up for my Christmas Eve dinner in the library cart. I knocked up a beefsteak pudding for one, with two kidneys, a dozen oysters, and a couple of mushrooms thrown in. It's a pudding to put a man in good humor with everything, except the two bottom buttons of his waistcoat. Having relished that pudding and cleared away, I turned the lamp low, and sat down by the light of the fire, watching it as it shone upon the backs of Sophie's books. Sophie's books so brought Sophie's self, that I saw her touching face quite plainly, before I dropped off dozing by the fire. This may be a reason why Sophie, with her deaf and dumb child in her arms, seemed to stand silent by me all through my nap. I was on the road, off the road, in all sorts of places, north, and south and west and east, winds like best and winds like least, here and there and gone astray, over the hills and far away, and still she stood silent by me, with her silent child in her arms. Even when I woke with a start, she seemed to vanish, as if she had stood by me in that very place only a single instant before. I had started at a real sound, and the sound was on the steps of the cart. It was the light hurried tread of a child, coming clambering up. That tread of a child had once been so familiar to me that for half a moment I believed I was a-going to see a little ghost. But the touch of a real child was laid upon the outer handle of the door, and the handle turned, and the door opened a little way, and a real child peeped in. A bright little comely girl with large dark eyes. Looking full at me, the tiny creature took off her mite of a straw hat, and a quantity of dark curls fell about her face. Then she opened her lips, and said in a pretty voice, "Grandfather." "Ah, my God!" I cries out. "She can speak." "Yes, dear grandfather. And I am to ask you, whether there was ever anyone, that I remind you of?" In a moment Sophie was round my neck, as well as the child, and her husband was a-wringing my hand with his face hid, and we all had to shake ourselves together, before we could get over it. And when we did begin to get over it, and I saw the pretty child a-talking, pleased and quick, and eager and busy, to her mother, in the signs that I had first taught her mother, the happy and yet pitying tears fell rolling down my face. End of the Project Gutenberg text of Dr. Marigold by Charles Dickens. DRMRG by Gutenberg Edition.